Hi, everybody. Are there any announcements that people would like to make?
This is Frank Niepold. I have one quick one. The ocean literacy community and climate literacy community in the federal government have agreed on the word that we're going to use for literacy so we can finish the Spanish translation, and that's going to be cultura. We've been kicking this around for 6 to 8 months, and I think we finally got everything done, so we'll be begin laying out and publishing and finalizing the climate literacy in Spanish version very soon.
Nice. And what's the word?
Cultura.
Cultura.
A lot of people think it's a little odd, but that we'll be using that, but the other candidate word basically meant you can read letters. The Spanish don't really use the word literacy the way we use it, and so we've been struggling with how to properly transfer this concept to Spanish.
And what is the actual translation of that word?
It basically means it's a. I actually don't know the answer to that, but it means that you use it in life, in essence. So it's
you use it in what?
Life, like it's
life. Oh, use it in life. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can see that.
Does anybody speak Spanish on the phone and agree with that statement?
Sí, señor.
Hi, Mark.
Estupendo.
Even in Spanish, we recognize your voice.
Okay, any other announcements? I would like to remind everybody that a lot of us are going to be at the AGU meeting at the beginning of December. There are 5 climate literacy sessions covering a wide range of topics. And poster sessions, there were 107 papers submitted to those sessions, so it should be really interesting and exciting. So looking forward to seeing everybody who can be there. Any other announcements?
I got cut off as Doug, so I missed any announcements. Didn't anyone else get cut off?
No.
When you put on the recording, I got knocked off.
Really? I'm sorry.
I just don't know what happened. So I'm sure they'll be in the notes.
Okay. All right. Well, if there are no other comments, I will introduce our speaker today. It's Dr. Susan Burr. She is director of a series of education and outreach at the University of Colorado Boulder. And she's going to be talking to us today about navigating climate change in the classroom, teacher preparation practices and perceptions. And the other thing I wanted to let you know is she's also a co-PI of the Clean Pathway Project, which many of us, as you know, are part of. So, Susan, I'll let you go from there. There are 2 versions of Susan's slides, 1 PowerPoint and 1 a PDF. And I gather the PDF version was put there because it doesn't translate well to Max, the PowerPoint version. So
right.
Hopefully everybody has a slide.
Okay. So, hi, everybody. I'm glad to be here and glad to hear so many names I know on the phone. My remarks today are going to be about data that we've gathered as part of our Inspiring Climate Education Excellence project, our NASA-funded project, and as part of our evaluation for the CLEAN project. And I gave a shorter version of this talk for the NRC roundtable, whenever that was. Time flies. But I've added some more data from that work. So it's looking at teacher patterns of instruction, what kind of perceptions they have around climate change and climate science, and what sort of preparation they've had. And please chime in and tell me if there's something going on with any sound issues or if I've advanced a slide and not said advance the slide and confused everybody. So with that, I will advance a slide to the introduction slide. And the data that we have is about teacher preparation and what influences them and what sort of professional development they've had or find valuable, also what sort of resources they're looking for and what they need. But my remarks today are going to focus on the teacher preparation part, knowledge, strategies, and practices, especially as they are influenced by controversy. Next slide. I'm describing where this data comes from. It is building, it's built on work that was done in our group in 2007. Sarah Weiss was the first person who started assessing this in the U.S. with Colorado teachers, and her paper was published in 2010 in Journal of Geoscience Ed. And building on some of that, we did a needs assessment, a national needs assessment in 2009. We did another national survey of teachers in 2010 as part of the CLEAN project. And then from that first survey group, we invited people to participate in a CLEAN informant network. And those people were surveyed again in 2011. I've provided the sample size for secondary science teachers that are part of those surveys. I do include some undergraduate data on some of my slides, so I'll point that out when I do, that are not included in this end.
One quick question. Are those needs assessments published somewhere?
Let's see. They are published on Workspaces. I don't think we have them. I don't think we have the report public on a website, but we certainly could, especially with the IC needs assessment and with the report of the 2011 data. So maybe I should put that on my IC website.
If you do put it publicly, it'd be great to send it to the network, just so we can build off of common understandings.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to look at it for identifiable info and stuff like that. I mean, it's not there, but...
Yeah. So, Susan, when you're ready, we can also post it right here with your slides, so if people wanted knew about your talk, they could get at it also.
And I'm also writing a paper for JGE that covers some of this data. So the article will be there. But one of the things that characterizes these groups is that they become more engaged in climate education. So in 2009, only 61% were engaged in teaching formal climate lessons, which I still think is pretty good. But then as you go on, the samples have more engagement. So for our 2011 sample, those tend to be more teacher leaders, teachers who have had a lot of professional development and who are engaged informal climate education, but I'll tell you more about what that actually means for these samples. So next slide. What have you heard from teachers about their preparation and their perceptions? We'll just take a couple of comments.
It's too complex.
It's too complex. Who said that?
Candace.
Hi, Candace.
Because it involves so many different systems.
Very interdisciplinary.
Interdisciplinary and systems of the earth, hydrology, geology, biology.
Yep. And what else?
They want to but they are interested in being able to, I mean, you're saying it's too complex, but they're also saying they want to be able to address these questions. So there's a need.
Mm-hmm. And who was that speaking?
This is Kristen Poppleton at the Will Steger Foundation.
Hey, Kristen.
Hey.
They want to understand it. What do they tell you about the currency of their knowledge?
Minimal. They don't feel comfortable with the science, or in some cases they don't have a lot of administrative support to do it as well.
Mm. Okay.
Ditto.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that we see that in our data too, and it varies from sample to sample. But we'll talk about some of the things. One of the reasons you can't generalize about this group, right? Some teachers are very comfortable, have spent a lot of time getting professional development and trying to understand climate science, but others, this is new. So when we ask about what kinds of learning experiences people have had, the majority of the learning experiences that people have had been self-directed. So looking at websites, looking at TVs and documentaries, looking at books and magazine articles. And as we know, those public media modes are full of misinformation and off-topic, irrelevant, red herring kinds of information. So it's very confusing to get your information from the public media. Many of them in these samples have had professional development through conferences or workshops. Very relatively few have had in-service through their school district. Those tend to be short or variable in length. Sometimes they are extended experiences, but more often they're not. And then a subset, about 30% or so, have had college classes or graduate courses through either their degree programs or postgraduate work as teachers. Very few have had no learning experiences at all. So that's, I think, a good thing. Next slide. If you look at where these respondents' degrees are and how they perceive them in terms of their helpfulness, those who have geoscience and environmental science degrees find them to be the most relevant. Those whose highest degree is in education is somewhat mixed, but generally sees it as not relevant to climate science. I don't know what goes into the other. I don't know. I'd have to look at that other category to see what those degrees are. But the thing that I think is really interesting is that the teachers that have biology degrees, not a single one said that was relevant to climate. And when you think about all of the human impacts and the impacts on ecosystems, a lot of those fall into a biology or life sciences area. And so I think that so far we haven't really done a good job of communicating to biology teachers or biology-comfortable people about where the entry points are for them in this topic.
I agree. Well, that's interesting, because that's where you put the face on the issue, too.
That's right. That's right. But we've been talking about
Susan,
it as a physical science. Mm-hmm.
But there's another piece to this, which is, climate change is one piece of this, but the whole piece of habitat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the climate plays a huge role in habitat. And so, I mean, even without climate change, you should be have some connection to this. But maybe that's not how they're just not seeing it that way.
I think that people just don't know what the discipline encompasses. They know it's interdisciplinary, but they don't know where their particular disciplinary expertise fits in.
Because I think it also, the liberal arts encompasses a whole range of social science kinds of issues, economics, and things like that. And it's very relevant to those areas also.
Right, right. Well, everything I look at, because of what I do every day, looks like climate change. So, so you see all the entry points, but we need to make those explicit for teachers who are just approaching this topic. So I think there's a huge area of opportunity there, especially when you consider that, 95% of high school students take biology? So I think there's a lot of opportunity there. We'll see where it's actually getting taught on a different slide. Let's see. Next slide is what this preparation, how I don't think this will be a surprise to anybody, but teachers express more comfort with Earth systems concepts like the ocean circulation and the reason for the seasons, less comfort with kind of molecular level climate concepts about how does the greenhouse effect actually work, what makes a greenhouse gas, why is methane considered a more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, things like that. Less comfort with emerging topics such as what does science say are the expected impacts where they live, and less information about the most current evidence of how scientists know what they know. And you can see the influence of the public dialogue on this last one about how scientists know, because there's so many red herrings out there. So as a result, misinformation that is out there for teachers, such as this, is it unstoppable solar cycles, gets more traction than we would hope. And we see in our evaluation data people saying things like, I was confused by this because it looks professional. And unless you really kind of examine the rhetoric and the state of the evidence that's being provided, it's hard to know that it's not trustworthy. And because of this learning from the public dialogue and having less comfort with these issues, it makes teachers more susceptible. Now, next slide, looking at some data from Sarah Weiss's paper. She asked about...
For anybody who came in late, this is slide 8.
That's right. This is data from Sarah's paper in JGE, and she asked about different perceptions and different thoughts that teachers had in Colorado about this. And you can see that this one with the red circle, at that time in 2007, about 45 to 50% of the teachers agreed or somewhat agreed that there was substantial disagreement among scientists about the cause of recent global warming. Also, 35% thought that science that goes against global warming theory is suppressed, that it was actually not getting out there because of some sort of bias in the scientific community. So that's where we were in Colorado in 2007. In our 2009, here's from Clean 2011, if you add up these, it's a similar question. It's not the exact same wording, but scientists agree about the causes of recent climate change. If you add those up, you get to the early 40s. So it's slightly better than it was in 2007, slightly better on the high school level than it was in 2007. But one of the things that I think is interesting about this slide, and this is the one that includes undergraduate faculty, is that when you get to the upper division faculty, it starts to become more polarized. So that's consistent with what people see in society, where those, you know, even those who least accept the evidence for human-caused climate change will say that they know a lot about it. So there is a correlation oftentimes out there about degree of education and polarization. And you can see that to a certain extent in this data. Those faculty tend to be teaching geology courses or meteorology courses more than general environmental courses. And there is more denialism among those communities. So I don't know. I don't know what information sources people are seeing. One thing, that area of where scientists agree is the place where we do see the most movement in terms of teachers' perceptions after professional development. This is workshop evaluation data associated with the ICE project. Most of the teachers came in thinking that global warming was happening and being...
You moved to the next slide, correct?
Oh, yeah. I moved to professional development shifts knowledge, slide 10. So most people came in with, you know, a fair amount of concern about recent climate change and accepting the evidence that climate change is happening rapidly now. We saw more movement, stronger agreement with the idea that the cause is because of human activities, and we saw the most movement in their understanding of the level at which scientists agree. And the reason for that, is they express it, is because of the time they spent with climate scientists, where climate scientists were talking about their work.
Susan, on this slide, have you ever asked questions? It seems like the progression you have here, the whole solution piece would show up as a, you know, I mean, the question's been asked many ways. It's like, can we solve it? Is it still time to solve it? You know, we know how to solve it, everything, you know, all those kind of questions. Does that show up in your work? Because, you understand why I asked the question.
Yeah. We haven't asked that particular question about their stance on how much humanity can move on this. You know, frankly, myself, my answer to that question varies from day to day.
The reason I'm asking the question is because Krosnick's work of 2006 shows that, you know, if you don't focus on if you accept the problem and it's human caused and all that stuff, if you don't also have a commensurate solution to the problem of that magnitude, then it starts setting up some problems on accepting the problem.
I agree with that, and I'll talk about that, about what they're doing with solutions, at least the extent to which they're including solutions a little later on. I haven't asked them their personal opinion. We have asked them what they're doing in their instruction. So in 2007, about 85%, and now I'm on both sides reasoning, slide 11. In 2007, about 85% of Colorado teachers supported teaching both sides for some reason. And about half of those left that reasoning unclear. 25% thought that both sides were scientifically valid. And about 25% accepted the scientific evidence for recent climate change happening and humans causing it, but intended to privilege that view but allow discussion and things on other stuff that students thought, which I think is an appropriate way to handle it. And we see those same kinds of comments in our 2009-2011 data. Teachers telling us that it's premature and overhyped, too much media, too little long-term science investigation, the old ice age thing. Now I'm supposed to teach the opposite of the ice age when I learned that in late 1960. Climate gate comes up. How can I teach about global change if scientists are not being honest about their results? Skepticism about the whole enterprise and the validity of climate science and scientists. We get the same thing with reasoning being unclear, where teachers want materials to teach both sides of the argument. It's unclear. I've talked with a lot of teachers. It's unclear from these comments, and it takes more interview and more discussion to figure out where those teachers are coming from. Sometimes they are committed denialists. Sometimes they're confused about the state of the science, and they just don't know where it is and need professional development. That varies from teacher to teacher. And then there's some who are very pleased to know about valid data sites and evidence-based resources and databases.
We're on slide 14.
Oh, sorry. Yes, we're on slide 14. And let the facts speak for themselves. A lot of the teachers describe wanting to present the evidence as a way to counter controversy. So we'll talk a little more about their instructional barriers. I'm about where I expect to be with slides right now, but let's just take a couple of questions on slide 15 about what do you hear from teachers about their concerns? What's holding them back, or at least being a bother in their day?
I mean, I'm hearing a lot of challenge from lots of different sectors about it's not necessarily what they think. It's that the parents or the students or the faculty or the chair or the supervisors are challenging the science or doesn't think it's appropriate or wants the balance or stuff like that. So it's more just having to navigate all of that is difficult for them.
Right. It's risky. What else?
They don't have their curriculum resources to do it. They don't have the materials don't know where to get them.
Mm-hmm. I would say that. I would agree with that.
I've heard from one... We're not working with a lot of teachers yet, Susan. This is Nick.
Yeah, hi, Nick.
But of the small group that we're working with right now, one has said it's just that pedagogically she feels like it's important to present both sides. She believes that it's happening, but as a science teacher, she thinks it's important to have students hear both sides.
Is she presenting both equally with equal validity?
Well, so far, what she's done is criticized she reviewed the first draft of our curriculum and criticized it for not presenting both sides.
Okay.
But she hasn't had the opportunity to use it yet.
Right. I think that's confusing for teachers. For environmental educators, teaching multiple stakeholder viewpoints is a valid strategy. And a desirable strategy, But that's a different thing than teaching both sides of science, where one is, you know, credible and the other one's not. So I think it's misplaced in terms of the science, but I think it's completely appropriate when you're talking about policies and solutions.
But you know, Susan, one of the things that I've been evolving in my personal perspective on this is that in the interdisciplinary space of this subject, teaching mm-hmm. all sides and perspectives and beliefs and all that fun and rich and interesting human stuff is wonderful, but but the both sides of the science, it gets very tricky very fast because
mm-hmm.
it's not science.
Yep, that's right.
And that's that. So it's not. I think saying there is no other perspective is not correct. But to say that there's no other science on this, well, I mean, certain things are uncertain in the science, obviously. But
right.
that's not what we're talking about here.
That's
and so
right.
I think splitting those two things apart and saying we'll teach the other perspectives on climate change, but not the question I have on that is it appropriate in the science course?
Right.
As opposed to only if it's only being taught in the science course, then you're losing ground on your cover, you know, what you're going to do.
Right, I agree. So I'll talk some of the ways. I'll talk about one of the ways that teachers handle that. The only point I want to make about slide number 16 is that over the years we've heard these top instructional barriers that they lack alignment with their standards or don't know where climate topics are fitting. Lack of personal content knowledge and comfort taking those risks of dealing with the parents and the administrators and their colleagues, and parent-student beliefs just as being a difficulty. And over the years, now in 2011, we're seeing that controversy concern as being top over the other two. And for our group of teachers, it's not clear to me whether or not controversy experiences have increased. You could think that they would because there's been more of these balanced education bills and, you know, a lot more effort put into it by well-funded people. But also, since these teachers are so engaged, I just don't know if they've solved the standards alignment and the content knowledge problems. But at any rate, there's another study that I'm not showing because it's not our work. Learn More About Climate, another Colorado organization at CU, did a study of Colorado teachers, and they also found that controversy was the top concern for that group. There's probably some overlap, but anyway, there's some confirming indicators out there. Now, the kinds of strategies teachers tell us about that they use to deal with this comes while they're planning and during instruction. So before instruction, they are making clear to align with their standards and curriculum. If you look at controversial topics policies for school districts, it has to be clearly part of the course of study if you're going to approach something publicly controversial. So that's important. They're framing for their learners' perspectives. So, for example, I talked with a group of teachers last week that they don't say global warming or humans causing climate change first. They talk about climate systems and ocean influences and El Nino influences on Colorado and work up from there. They work with the climate system first and then work into recent climate change from there. And they just use different words. Just like with evolution, people are saying change over time instead of evolution. Finding high-quality resources, especially those with lots of data and evidence and that are inquiry-based. And then some talk with administrators. And depending on their situation, that may or may not be a good idea. But we usually suggest to teachers that they do talk with their science coordinator or their principal or whoever they can more or less trust is going to have their back if they start getting parent calls about this. And sometimes there isn't somebody. But it's something that they should consider when they're planning. On slide 18, I'm describing some of the things that they tell us. So the first go-to strategy, and this won't be a surprise, I think, to people, is to start off with the evidence, start with data, start with inquiry. They say things to me like, it's right there. The data is right there. How can people argue with that? And, you know, people do. But That's the first go-to strategy. Using controversy as a teachable moment, what I would say about that conversation we were having earlier about both perspectives or both sides, the strategy that we promote is to be doing formal lessons using the scientifically credible resources, things that are coming from climate science and climate scientists. But then students are going to bring up misinformation and bring up other stuff they've heard, in which case we encourage teachers to use that as a teachable moment and have students look at different lines of evidence or claims in terms of how credible they are. And, you know, they should be learning about the nature of science and what constitutes credible information. So you can put it back on a student in terms of, I want you to go research the basis for that claim. Find out what you can find.
We have a teacher at our institute this summer who said something, I mean, pretty much the same thing, but if she has a student that says, I want to do research on why this is not happening, she says, well, bring me, you know, a credible source that proves this, then, you know, I'll let you write the paper, but you have to use sources that are credible. And,
right,
of course, she can't, or they can't ever. So,
right.
She puts it on the student, back on them, rather than saying, no way.
I think that's totally appropriate. And I think that, you know, even with credible information, students maybe should be making a case. It's going to be a better case.
Well, and having the students understand what it means to be a credible source is
exactly.
A really, really important skill as well. So,
that's right.
Yeah.
No, they're going to leave your classroom, and what do they need to know when they're gone? Another thing that teachers do is to integrate climate throughout so that if it is just an example of what they've already learned in Earth systems, if teachers are making connections to climate science concepts throughout a course in environmental science or Earth science, it makes it harder to reject. It's not the standalone topic that Al Gore started. it's just another example of things that they've already learned and accepted. They bring in outside speakers to talk about how it is, life as a scientist. Our teachers say things like, to our scientists, they say, we wish everybody in America could talk to you because, you know, it's so clear that you are not some crazy person, some wild-eyed activist who wants to take over the economy. It's so clear when that depth of expertise that's been built over decades is speaking. And then, as Frank was saying, integrating solutions helps. There's work that shows that that if students are not learning, or if adults have not learned about solutions information along with climate change facts, they don't accept them to the same degree as if solutions information is there. And also, there's other work, new, relatively recent work with teachers, where students who are having a more forward-looking experience with climate science can engage with the topic better. They get upset if you just leave them with, here's all the impacts and you're the generation that's going to solve it, but I'm not going to give you any clues about how to do that. It's pretty difficult for the students.
Well, one of the key words in that solutions piece is commensurate. Because we make this a global problem humanity's never faced, the biggest problem we've ever going to face, as far as we know, and then the solutions are very small, personal, and it's not commensurate. So Krosnick's research points out that very clearly, and I think that we'd be well served by looking at, you know, all scales of solutions together as opposed to, you know, small stuff that's maybe going to add up.
But as much as I agree with her, we can't integrate Naomi Klein's solutions without, you know, creating chaos. I don't know if everybody got to read that piece that was sent around that came from The Nation, but it's very radical and very sobering and probably very on target.
I don't know that piece. Was it sent to the Climate Literacy Network?
I believe so.
Yeah, I sent it out a week or so ago, and it's basically saying that capitalism itself is part of the problem if we're going to actually realistically deal with climate change. we have to look carefully at how flawed the free market system is, and that's something obviously in a science class it would be distracting and problematic.
Right. So, you know, I don't know exactly how to do this, clearly. I think that we're going to have to learn from teachers who are succeeding. A lot who are succeeding with a significant amount of solutions integration are partnering with a social studies teacher.
Right.
Or something like that. I think that's where we see
a lot of the biology integration, because the citizen science piece can be a piece of a solution as well, or we sort of frame it as a possible solution. So that's where we've done some with phonology and,
mm-hmm.
and keeping track of what they're seeing kind of piece.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you, Kristen?
Yeah, that is me.
Great.
That is me. And then we have our, you know, we do a lot with youth engagement in more of the out-of-school setting, though, but giving them the skills to civically engage as well, which not all teachers are obviously as comfortable or interested in, but
mm-hmm.
that being also a very powerful way to get students involved.
Right. I bet this would be a good topic for a whole, for a webinar for CLN, if that hasn't been done already, about how to do the solutions piece. But I wanted to point out that we have some teaching videos on our IC website that are about doing that kind of integration and dealing with controversy. This one, it's not numbered. It's the one that's after slide 18, is from Cheryl Manning talking about how she integrates climate into her curriculum, where she's starting in what she calls a safe zone and then working out from there, and how she's handling the potential controversy, because she did have some issues and she's learned from that. There's other teaching videos like that that some of them are on iconline.org, which is directing to our workshop resource site right now. Let's see, where climate topics are being taught. The green ones are where it's being taught. You know, 80% of the teachers or more are teaching climate in earth and space science, in environmental science, and in social studies. And so keep in mind, these are climate-engaged folks. This, I'm not making a claim that 80% of 90% of social studies in general are teaching climate topics at all. I'm just saying this is where our climate-engaged teachers are teaching. More than 60%, between 60 and 72% are integrating it into biology, chemistry. I was interested in this computers technology one. That was a surprise to me. Middle school, it's more in general science. It's in physical science. And then the lowest place where people are integrating climate topics is in physics. So less than 50% of our respondents are integrating it there. So I don't know how we bring those numbers up. Well, I have some ideas, of course. But I think we find people who are doing it and make it easier for other people to do it. Where are they integrating it and showing examples? Now, on slide 21, Sarah found in 2007 that the more human-focused topics were receiving less instructional time, and you'll find that's also true for evolution-focused topics. I suspect that this is true for lots of topics, that if you're talking about water resources, for example, that you might talk about the water system first more than you do human use of water. But at any rate, as you got towards more human climate concepts, there was less class time allocated to it. Now, in terms of, on slide 22, how much instructional time is actually being devoted to climate topics, about 70%, 60 to 70%, are spending 25% or less time. In middle school, 20%, and in high school, 30% are spending less than 10%. So, you know, it's pretty rare to have a whole course that's about climate, although they do exist. And so that makes that integration issue so much more important. If you only have time for a couple of lessons about climate topics or one unit, it means that in order to have that be meaningful, it's got to be well connected to the rest of the course. And you've got to be kind of signposting back and forth between bigger concepts and climate concepts. I will see. Oh, here's one that's kind of fun. Slide number 23. We asked clean respondents, the 2011 group, which teaching practices they thought their students would be most interested and engaged by. And so there's a whole list of them, lectures, discussion, student research, field trips, using scientific data, studying a local problem. And then we asked what teaching practices they were actually using in the classroom. And so up here with lectures and discussions, there's a mismatch. Nobody thought that their middle school students were going to be interested in lectures. But you know, of course, it's a big teaching strategy, and sometimes, you know, the students have to listen to stuff that they don't want to listen to. But they might be wanting to do something more engaged, but you can see that there's pretty good correspondence when it comes to hands-on lab activities. There's decent correspondence when it comes to student research. Teachers are actually using that more than they think their students are interested. But ideally, we'd want to be helping teachers move over into these other areas where nobody mentioned using these strategies, doing more creative work, doing more study of local issues or problems. Let's see. Now, one thing that's interesting, on slide 24, we asked how do they integrate cross-topic. We asked about cross-topic in terms of just science topics, and we asked about the mix between science only and science and society. And this gets back to some of the discussion we've been having. About 50% say that they are teaching equally science and social implications or social aspects of it. And, you know, those are mostly science teachers, so a lot of people are making inroads that way in science class. But about 40% say mostly only science, which is another valid choice in science class, but you still want to give this kid something to do with it. Here's another teacher saying that this may not be on the PDF. On the PowerPoint, there's a text box that says, by connecting this in the physical science curriculum, I've been able to bring it in without really labeling it climate science. It's another example of teachers entering into the topic without calling it global warming. They're kind of easing into it. In terms of the extent to which solutions are considered, there is actually, I think this is also pretty encouraging. At the middle and high school level, there's actually quite a bit of solutions being considered. We didn't ask them to describe for that survey question what they meant by solutions being considered. I don't know how meaningful that consideration is and how integrated it is, but at least it's there and teachers are thinking about it. I guess I don't see a lot of clear differences with the lower division and upper division, but I guess a little less consideration of solutions during science class. It's kind of mixed. But I'm just glad that it's there, that there are so many people who are considering solutions. Let's see. You all know about the CLEAN collection, I'm sure. This is one place where we send teachers to look for solutions-oriented information because of the energy resources in there. We did ask about the availability and value of existing teaching resources. Generally, teachers feel that climate resources are more available than energy teaching resources, and so they feel that they have more support, more resources available for climate than they do for energy. Now, if you ask about the quality of the resources that are available and the value to them, that is less. They say that resources are available generally, But they say that the resources are good more than they say they're excellent. And so I think that there are some things that we can learn from what teachers want in terms of the resources we're providing. We also asked what kinds of resources they want more of, that they need for different groups. In the secondary classroom, teachers are looking more for resources for low reading level and for remedial math or lower than grade level math skills, but they're kind of looking across the board. When you get to the undergraduate teachers, undergraduate faculty, the quantitative piece is much larger. Teachers, faculty are looking for resources to use with students who have sketchy quantitative skills. Again, I think that's something that we can learn from as developers and professional developers. I'm not going to talk a lot. I want to leave time for questions, so I'm going to go a little faster. But Sarah found in 2007 the same thing that Frank was talking about, that discouragement and encouragement was coming from a lot of different sources. For discouragement, it was mostly administrators or other teachers, parents, and family. Encouraging experiences were also coming mostly from teachers. And this is a slide that got split up for because of the animation. So on my slide 28, I've got both graphs. You should have a graph that shows the where the experiences are coming from. But then also, the next slide, if you're on the PDF, says that the encouraging experiences had a greater effect than the discouraging experiences. In some cases, getting discouragement made people more committed to teaching climate topics. But encouragement had a stronger effect on enhancing teachers' teaching, making them more comfortable with it, making them do it more. So I think that that's a place where this community can really have a play, which is to try and get teachers more and more involved in communities and getting that support. These teachers, on my PowerPoint, this has slide 29. It's got a picture of a forum. It's called Participation in PD/Community. Most of these teachers do perceive institutional support from their schools and their school districts. Keep in mind that these are teachers who are engaged in climate education mostly, so you would expect them to be in a more supportive context. Most say that they are perceived as a resource by their peers, so they are the go-to climate person in their building. About 70% of them, I think was the number, have personal connections to climate scientists, people that they can call or ask about something they don't understand or if something is valid. They belong to national science and education communities in their professional lives, things like AGU and GSA or organizations like NSTA or NESTA or NAGT. And then outside of their professional lives, they participate as citizens. More than half of them participate as citizens in local and regional communities that are focused on climate and energy topics. So they might participate with their city environmental board or something like that. But a lot of them are participating locally and regionally. So they have reach from national. They have connections from national organizations like many of the people on the call, all the way down to their building. So I think that that's a place that we should really look when we're trying to make a change, helping those people be a better resource for their colleagues, helping them know what they should be what they can share, and really helping those connections at different scales happen. I've posted a URL for our IC forum where some of you are members, and the listserv, if you want to be on the listserv, email me at susan.burr@colorado.edu. A lot of times the teachers are more comfortable participating in listservs than they are on the forums. So one of my job as a moderator is take the interesting conversations that happen on the listserv and put them on the forum so that we have an archive, synthesize them and put them on the forum so that they don't just go into the ether and get lost. Let's see. It won't be a surprise to know that even for these engaged teachers, they have had, a lot of them, I'm on slide 30, a lot of them have had 1 to 2 weeks. Some have had 3 to 4 weeks of professional development. But as we know from research, it takes on the order of 1.5, 2 weeks to 4 weeks of PD before people start seeing significant changes in their practice. And it's got to be tied to their curriculum and to their teaching needs. So just helping the community get more professional development over time. I don't think it needs to be provided by any one of us, but I think there's a lot of room for partnerships and niches between us where we can help share our teacher communities and bring people from one experience to another. I wanted to point out a couple of upcoming opportunities that are coming from the IC and CLEAN projects, and then I'll end. So we'll be teaching an online course as part of the IC project in spring. There's three grad credits from environmental studies. You can also take it for continuing ed or for a nominal administration fee if you don't want credit. We'll be covering teaching strategies and the essential principles of climate literacy. The capstone course will be to develop and implement and reflect with the community on a localized teaching activity, something that is about climate and climate change in your place. If you're interested in that and want to be on the mailing list when the registration link is open, email me. And then you may already know that CLEAN is providing webinars for teachers once a month, and the next one is December 15th. You can find a description at this URL. CIRC has set the dates for the upcoming faculty workshops. April will be about communicating climate science in the classroom, and May will be about teaching climate complexity. So those are some upcoming opportunities. And with that, I just want to point out that we have a lot of challenges, and we know what they are. I misspelled that. But there are also a lot of opportunities. You know, there's a lot more of us here interested in this topic now. We're a lot more. I tend to be an optimistic person, so I see a lot of potential for us to do our work together in a more coordinated fashion and just really learn from each other. And with the next generation science standards, I'm pretty hopeful that there's going to be a lot of impetus for standards alignment there. So with that, I will take any questions. Do we have time for that, Tamara?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So, Susan, this is Frank. One thing that I think some of us have talked about, and I'm very keen on doing, is I've been speaking with some educational researchers about doing a lit review on pedagogical research-based strategies that have come out over the years, mostly out of the environmental education world,
mm-hmm.
that to really have a deeper understanding of the ways of teaching as deeply understood as the what to teach. I think we've spent more time, and maybe this isn't a fair point, and anybody feels we should push back, please do so. But we've spent more time on the what and not so much on the how. And I think, and you're bridging that here in this conversation, but I think that there's, I hear from Joe Heimlich or Tom Marcinkowski or others that there's a big body of work out there that I think we would benefit from having a deeper valuing and understanding that would help us move some of this forward. And I'm specifically referring to one particular work that was done by Hungerford and Volk on critical issue analysis in the middle school grades,
mm-hmm.
And what skills to use and build that are transferable and things of that nature. But, it's new for me to really deeply dive into this stuff, but I think there's some lessons that we can learn out there and apply here.
I agree with you. There's a lot I think we do need to be pulling from other bodies of literature. And that's a big job on
yeah.
this topic. And you have to be, if you're pulling that kind of lit review, you're going to have to be careful about what is the scope, what are you actually trying to accomplish?
So one of the things that we're talking about actually tomorrow is writing that scope of work to put some boundaries on that lit review and to have a near-term product so that we, you know, it's not a full-scale research project, but to have a really good set of those research-based practices.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I mean, it just we the other piece of that is obviously is the skills that we want literate citizens to have, as well as the contents and you know, topics that they want to be knowledgeable about. But it's not just knowledge; it's skill as well. So anyway,
right? You have some fellowship money lined up for that, Frank? Yet?
On the money, don't ask about money these days.
Oh, I know. I'm sorry. That's
did you guys not see all the notes about NOAA and climate and FY12 budget?
Yeah.
But now that said, though, one of the things I think is important is to characterize if there are some key gaps in that and then work with organizations like NSF to target their solicitations to sharpen the focus on those key areas where there are gaps. But once we characterize the field, we won't know where they are and be able to transfer that to NSF to guide their, so I mean I'm trying to spend NSF's money.
Mm-hmm. I would say that there's gigantic gaps. If you look at the literature on climate education, most of it is about misconceptions.
Right.
And if it's talking about teachers at all, usually it's about pre-service teachers. And there's been precious little done on teacher instructional patterns and teacher perceptions. Very little. Especially in the U.S. So, you know, we're going to have to draw from the other controversy literature, the environmental ed literature, environmental topics in society, all those kinds of things to move forward.
Well, and that's where Frank was there when I asked this question at NAAAE, but I was sort of balked at, but I really do feel like climate change ed has been pulled out from the environmental ed umbrella, despite the fact that it is environmental. I mean, that's what it is. We're doing environmental education. It's just the next issue that sort of came out. Whereas there has been, you know, identified pedagogy of environmental ed that's a ton of research behind, but somehow we pulled it out. And I think it's fascinating. And I mean, I wonder if there is a different, there is a way, a different way of doing this, because this is such a pressing issue that we're going beyond, you know, entering a different way or a need with how it should be taught.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is Tamara. I think that it's become so interdisciplinary. I mean, beyond any other discussion about interdisciplinary topics in the past, because this impacts on all aspects of people's lives and communities, and we're not used to teaching in that kind of a mode, and that's why I think it's so different than other ways we've been doing it in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But the other interesting thing about that, Tamara, to take that one step further, is that as the next generation science standards come through, how to organize the coursework, both in the sciences and then across the sciences and then across the other disciplines. Yeah, I mean, there's some really interesting, rich pieces of work out there that have very sizable implications on how we teach. And I think if we don't address those, we're going to have a really hard time nibbling at the edges and making sizable progress here. So I think, having these large-scale structural conversations toward our ultimate objective is due.
And that sets the stage for my question, Susan, which is, this is Doug. I want to ask it from your subject group, but also make just a reflection, follow-up comment about the network and its maturing. So the question is, do you have anecdotal evidence from teachers of attempting to deploy students as both peer and community educators, as both community service and action kinds of steps beyond their acquisition of knowledge? And the reflection about the maturity of the network, just to put your answer in context. So several years ago, Mark developed a PowerPoint presentation, and we got all excited about developing students as community educators. So in terms of my bias about the net of not just climate education, but good education is about creating citizen leaders who become mm-hmm. active in solutions in these, you know, challenging times for our human family. So do you have anecdotes of teachers trying to do that?
Oh, yeah. Now, it tends to be the teachers who are very energetic and very committed. But we have examples of, in our IC project, a teacher who had her students develop new transportation strategies for their city and presented that and got buy-in from their city to do something new with their transportation. I don't know that it's actually happened, but those were sixth graders. And so I think there's a lot of things that can happen. A lot of the teachers are developing materials for their students to communicate with either their younger students or in the community. One of our teachers had his students develop brochures about the impact of climate on particular sectors in Pennsylvania, like the impact on the dairy industry, impact on lots of different things with data to then share with people in that economic activity. How far that actually gets and how seriously it gets taken varies. I find anecdotally that it is much harder for adults in power to be dismissive of children who are talking to them about the things.
And Doug, this is Tamara also, which is a nice segue to next week. We have a project here that I've partnered on with Dr. Juliet Rini Varga at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, who's giving the talk next week on this Climate Literacy Network call, on climate change education, student media productions to educate and engage. They have both activities within the college-level students of producing media pieces that they there share with the broader community to engage, and then those students engaging with high school students in a summer program for high school students in which they, too, produce media pieces around climate change and brought that to the broader community there. So you might want to call in next week to hear more about that project. And we are 5 minutes over, so while this has been a really interesting and engaging discussion, I just wanted to let everybody know that we are past our time, so if you want to leave, that's perfectly fine. Those who still want to discuss can go on further if you'd like. So, but Susan, thank you very much for a very interesting talk.
Thanks, Tamara. Thanks for having me. I would like to say that ACE has student action teams and Alliance for Climate Education, and we're just starting that they will be supporting their teachers in part by using our forum. So I think they're learning some things too, and I know, Doug, that you have a lot to say about this.
And just so all of you to know, and I think it's been very helpful to take this next step, of I have an opportunity to lift up examples of both higher ed and high school student actors in this area at a national conference next year on the Association for Sustainability in Higher Ed. So I do want to follow up and get examples of, good, solid student work in this area. So,
Doug, I think one of the things you should reach out to the people over at Second Nature, because they are just moving to the second part of the President's Climate Commitment, which is the curricular part. The infrastructure part was the first part, which is probably the easier thing for universities and colleges and schools to do. And I know that they are interested in really understanding how that is. I mean, it would be wonderful if the two were merged, whereas you are doing all that infrastructure change, you're actually learning how to do that as part of your curriculum. But I think there's other parts of that there's a good opening there for the higher ed, for those 600 institutions who've committed to the President's Climate Commitment.
Sounds good. If for those that are not familiar, what Frank is talking about is actually Tony Cortese and Second Nature were the co-founders of AISHE, this national body of higher ed. So they were that Second Nature preceded AISHE, and they are integral to it.
Right. But I had reached out to them just to understand how because we know, I mean, I think a lot of us know that the universities and colleges are doing much more dynamic work in this space than a lot of the you know, secondary and primary grade levels. And so, you know, what characterizing and understanding it and seeing what's transferable and scalable is really rich and interesting. But so anyway, I know they're just getting to that part of the equation right now.
Thanks for that heads up.
Sure.
I was going to add to the REAMP network here in the Midwest, www.reamp.org. The other staff person here in our office is the youth climate coordinator for that, and that she works with all the university youth coalitions that are working on climate work here. And so there's some pretty exciting stories, anecdotes coming out of that as well. And I could connect you. It's Abby Fenton at the Wilfdegger Foundation.
Please do that.
Would you mind sending her contact information through the network?
Yeah. She presented last year, too. She's in there somewhere, but yep.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you all. Tamara.
Thanks.
All right. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.